Hello, everybody, and welcome to No Flicks Given. I'm Matt. With me, as always, are Connor, Peter, and Frank. How are you guys doing?
Hello, Internet. Good, man. How's it going with you?
Hey, everybody.
It's good to see all your faces.
Yes. And I think we've been doing a bit of a round robin to sort out kind of who's inflicting the movie on the next person.
Mm-hmm.
This time it is going to be Connor's choice. What have you submitted for our viewing pleasure?
I don't like the look on his face right now.
Well, the last two movies have been pretty heavy and pretty serious and classics. I decided that we should maybe move away from the heavy and serious, but remain in the classics.
Okay.
Submitted for your approval, 1984's Streets of Fire.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Which is a movie that I have not seen, but almost every video game that I played in the 90s and love was influenced by it. So I think we should go on a little neo-noir rock musical adventure together.
I'm pretty sure that's like Diane Lane and Willem Dafoe, right?
Correct. And Rick Moranis.
And Rick Moranis.
This is a
Jesus
very interesting
Christ.
Cast.
Directed by Walter Hill.
Oh, boy. All right, I have no idea what to expect.
I can hear a 16-bit menu music playing, starting to come into...
Well, the game, it's a lot like the Ninja Turtles kind of like...
Yeah, well, the video game Streets of Rage was inspired by this. It's almost a direct ripoff of this movie.
Which one was Streets of Rage?
It was the one where you went around punching guys. I don't know.
Is it Street Fighter? I'm getting them mixed up. Either way, just put the tape in.
You are about to enter a world unlike any you've ever seen before. Where rock and roll is king. The only law is a loaded gun. Where the beautiful...
Stay and see the show, it's really good.
The brutal...
I want Tom Cody.
And the brave all meet.
From now on, it's for real.
In Streets of Fire.
Guys, Streets of Fire might be my favorite movie.
Okay.
We just throwing it out there. It might be my favorite movie. I'm not sure yet, but it might be my favorite movie.
I'm excited for what we talk about here, is how I'm going to word it. We'll get into it, but I think we have to come clean with when and where, what happened with this episode.
Yeah.
I was just going to joke that the runtime said 90 minutes, but it took 3 months off of my life.
Okay.
Well, we could go that route.
So for anyone who is okay letting us spoil the illusion, like we'll record that intro,
if you will.
Yeah, a little peek behind the curtain. We'll record the intro way ahead of time, and then like a week or two will pass while we go and watch the movie, and we'll come back and record the rest of the episode. And for some reason or another, like life just got in the way, and we ended up recording the intro to this episode that you just heard seconds ago back in like early August. And Peter, what's today's date?
I've got November 8th on my phone.
Weird. I have November 10th.
Oh, we've all time traveled to different locations and we've been spit out of the time stream
Halloween
slightly
got
differently.
In the way.
So, cool.
Yeah, we had a lot going on. And I will add too, we ended up mm-hmm. picking up an extra speaker for this episode. So I brought along Mike Ludwig for to be a guest on this episode, kind of like within like a few days, like this was like Thursday. I was like, hey, do you want to be on this recording with me? So welcome, Mike, and thank you for jumping on and going through this adventure with us.
Thanks. I had no idea this movie existed.
Now you'll never
Excellent.
Forget it. For anyone who wants to know, Mike was on a lot of our episodes for Give It Five, and I think he ended up on the Fix-A-Flick feed for a while there. He was on Mummy Returns, Independence Day. This is another one in there that I'm blanking on now, but
yeah, there's like one more.
Yeah. Future TB recorded Jurassic World someday.
Jurassic World, yeah.
If we ever circle back to
yeah, that's the nightmare. 65 million years in the making. Yeah. Connor?
Frank?
Why did we watch this movie?
A couple of reasons.
It's a great question.
There was a couple of reasons. One, I saw, I don't know, some YouTube video that had mentioned it years past. And I was like, oh, shit, that looks like it's right up my alley. But then I did some research. And I discovered that the video games Streets of Rage and Final Fight were based on Streets of Fire.
Really?
They were inspired by Streets of Fire. And in 1996, if you wanted me to play a video game, all you had to do was give the enemies life bars. Matt, you know this. Yes. And I was obsessed with like beat 'em up brawler type games like that, where you like go and just beat up an unlimited number of henchmen. So I was like, oh shit, this is me. This is Connor going back to the origins, an origin story, and going and watching the original document that those are all based on. It's a not quite cyberpunk rockabilly action movie western.
I was trying musical. To think of this, Connor. So to me, this movie is very much Star Wars meets Blade Runner meets Back to the Future, but only when he goes back in time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's like all of my favorite things in one thing, and I hadn't seen the movie yet, and I needed an excuse to see it. And not unlike with Death Machine, I used our podcast as an excuse.
It was a lot of fun.
It's like, well, I want so I want to hear, because I don't know what a lot of us thought of this movie. But it is a little bit of like a like 50s greaser gang movie and a 80s musical were like a Reese's chocolate and peanut butter collision, you know?
Yeah.
Think of like music by Meatloaf set in a 50s dystopian future. With the plot of Star Wars, at least the first half of the original New Hope. It's going to save the princess. That's it.
You
guys are overcomplicating it. This is a story from Dark City. This is all this is. This is just a story from Dark City.
There's also that.
Right, it's that level of unreality.
I feel I went into this completely cold, and I don't know. I don't think I was expecting a 5-minute song of an intro.
Oh God, yes.
A banger of an intro, you mean?
That song is only, I don't even know, action. That song does not let up the entire time. And I definitely, without getting too far into it, I felt like I was like, I don't think I'm liking this.
Dude, that song plays out like a Family Guy joke where it goes on so long it stops being funny and then goes on so much longer
and then it becomes funny again.
That's why it's music by Meatloaf. It sounds like Meatloaf. And the reason that it sounds like music by Meatloaf is the man who produced a lot of these tracks is Jimmy Iovine. And Jimmy Iovine was famous for founding Interscope Records, but he got his start cutting his teeth. He produced, he was a record engineer. He was a sound engineer for John Lennon, Meatloaf. What was some of his other like early acts? But he like, you know, broke Nine Inch Nails and Gwen Stefani. Like the man is a legend of the music industry, and he produced like half of the tracks on the soundtrack.
And Ellen
and they all sound great.
Yeah. Let's do a little bit of a round robin just to get some general feedback of what does everyone actually think of this movie. So we'll do our guests first. Ludwig. Coming out of the other side of the Streets of Fire, what did you think?
I would say halfway through, I was still unconvinced, given dialogue and just what was happening throughout. And for some reason, as soon as they picked up the band, I was like in from then to the end. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is great. Everything's kind of like working now. Because I think so much time has gone on where you're like, the dialogue is fine. The world, sure.
No, it's not.
Like, none of this, like, you just succumb to it. And then from there on out, I was in. But I think it took me a while to get into it. But I enjoyed it. I didn't, halfway through, I was I said to Christina, I was like, I do not like this movie. And then by the end, it won me over.
Yeah.
I can totally see how the band in the bus singing the countdown to love makes the whole movie click into place if you're not already bought in. Because it's such a 1950s, like, it's not even rockabilly. It's a, I don't even know what that genre of music is, but it is like such a 1950s moment and jammed in between two very bombastic action scenes that you're like, okay, yeah. I get what this movie's about. All right, fine.
And McCoy just jumps in and drives the bus, and you're like, oh, I can drive anything. Sure, a bus. I don't know.
All right.
Well, that's when you get your fellowship. That's when you've got your squad. Like, that's
yeah.
Connor, we know where you stand, obviously. Peter, thoughts?
I really enjoy the first like 20 minutes of this movie. I thought the intro is great. I thought the fight choreography was fun. I really enjoyed the music at the outset. The second Michael Parr comes onto the screen and starts acting, the whole thing just flies off the rails because people actually start talking and trying to progress like a plot, and none of it's good.
Yeah, but screen presence, though. The man fills a frame.
Presence. I have a list of actors I would have rather seen in this movie that would have made the whole thing a lot better.
So did Walter Hill.
I believe that. Also, I can see the progression. One of the things we haven't talked about yet is Walter Hill is the same guy who made The Warriors. Mm-hmm. And I think you see a lot of the lessons that he learned making The Warriors in this movie. Similar set, a lot of similar shots. So I really enjoyed sort of the action in the extended credits sequence that does not end.
There are no credits in it. It doesn't have credits over that opening number.
That moment when the song ends, it's a banger. It ends with,
and then the title cards start popping up.
It ends with the bombers coming in and kidnapping her, causing all of that chaos. And you can see all of the people of Richmond freaking out that they have ruined this beautiful, magical moment. And then the credits start. Like the whole
kidnapped a very convincing
pre-credit sequence.
Yes, and that's kind of what I said, and I was like, okay, cool, whatever. A very convincing Diane Lane as a lead of a rock and roll 1950s group. She's great. She might be the best part of the movie.
18 years old when she made this.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So I liked, and then after that, it's like I liked sequences. Like I like the rescue sequence for as fucking ridiculous as that is. I want to know what like exploding bullets he was shooting out of his gun to make motorcycles explode into fireballs that quick.
He's got the Blade Runner gun.
Yeah. See, no, this movie works much better if you see it as a fantasy.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is why it opens with like in another time in a different place. Directly.
If you miss that.
If you miss that card. What's that?
If you miss that another time, another place, you'd be like, the fuck.
But if you're there for it, I mean, to me, that's what like sold me on the movie almost immediately. Was like, oh, in another time, another place, we're gonna fuck around with stuff. I love that.
It's a little Fallout-y in that it like it's like, what if we'd never progressed past the 1950s, but we kept moving forward in time?
Yes,
and in that all of the dialogue sounds like it was generated by an AI.
I'm glad there are no skirts on this call. Yeah.
Now I'm really curious what Matt thinks of this movie because he's throwing a couple of light jabs around and I need to let him take a real swing.
Just at the story and the dialogue and the acting. it's a movie that I watched it twice now, and I think that it is a movie that I enjoy. Like, it's one of those movies where you could leave on mute and just like enjoy all the visuals of.
Yeah.
I do think it might have been cut by two different editors, but that's a whole other thing. just by how weird, like, sometimes it gets very frenetic and sometimes it just eases off and, like, you forget that even somebody's bothering to cut between stuff.
It feels like they got the order that, like the first guy editing was doing, like, a very artistic, like, thorough job, and the production company was like, no, we got to go now. Finish it tomorrow.
The first guy was too much of a tryhard for me. Yeah. It was a little too fast-paced. What were you going to say, Connor?
Listed on the Wikipedia is three separate editors. So
that's starting to make sense.
But even in that first like 6 minutes or whatever, you get so many different... Like, you get Defoe revealed as a silhouette, which is awesome during the music sequence.
Defoe is visually great. Yeah.
And then you get, mm-hmm. 35 freeze frames during the credit sequence, and you're just like,
that's less good.
What?
Yes, that is one of the problems.
I'll say, and I think everyone who's been listening to our show, and you all especially know that I love a train wreck. This is such an objective disaster of a film on every level that I actually kind of adore it wholeheartedly. It's so weird.
I wouldn't say every level.
This might be the example that I love every movie and you hate every movie, Frank.
No. I'm not even being ironic about it. I've seen this movie when we first did this way back in August. I watched it a couple days after we recorded that intro, and then I watched it again the next night, unrelated to our podcast. So like I do genuinely enjoy watching this. But it's hard to argue because it is just so absurd that this was a film like this, that this came out and was the thing it was. Because I think it's just so aggressive with what it's trying to do. And it's so throwing so much at you. It's reminding me actually, and everyone on this episode was on the episode we did on The Shadow, actually. That was the other movie I forgot about that you were on, Ludwig. The Shadow, yeah. Which was like, you have to respect it's so aggressively trying all of these crazy things that even in its failure, you have to like have some admiration for like the attempt at such a type of movie that nobody wanted and nobody else was even trying to make at all.
There's a decent budget for this movie in
1980. Yeah.
$14.5 million.
The thing that made this movie happen was 48 Hours. Mm-hmm. Walter Hill had directed 48 Hours. Mm-hmm. It had been this unexpected, humongous hit. It was the breakout movie for Eddie Murphy. They made money hand over fist. And the studio was just like, what do you want to do?
Not only that, the producer of 48 Hours is none other than Joel Silver, who all of us have seen maybe 50 Joel Silver movies in our life. Like he did everything. He's like on the Bruckheimer level, just a little quieter. And he got involved and was like, we have a chance right now. We have like the studio right where we want. We can make absolutely anything. And so they just wrote something like completely original. I think there's the wiki on this movie is one of the best Wikipedia pages on any film ever because it's so thorough.
Yeah.
Where Walter Hill wanted to write. And if you read through the Wikipedia page, we won't go through too much of it now, but it reads like, you know, I've said this before in here, that those scenes in the Titanic where, oh, we can't find the binoculars. I'm sure it's fine. Oh, we're going a little bit too fast. I'm sure it's fine. Every single piece of the production of this, you're like, oh, that was a mistake. Oh, that you shouldn't have. Like you can see it in hindsight of like all the different things where Walter Hill was like, I wanted to write a movie without any of the boring parts. I wanted like gunfights and kissing in the rain and all this other stuff. And you're like, okay, but you can't just do that. You have to have a little bit of meat on the bone.
But he did. But that's exactly what he did. It's like rumbles and neon and kissing in the rain and trains.
That is, and they did make the exact movie they wanted.
That I mean, there's none of the connective tissue that should be there to actually make you care about those moments.
No, for the people that kind of went into this as cold as we all did. Did everyone else have a moment, probably like 15 minutes in, maybe 20? Where the same question popped in your heads that popped in mine, where you get a little bit into the movie, it's pretty much settled in, and you go to yourself, is this it? Is this the plot? This is all this movie is like the most aggressively simple kidnap, rescue the princess kind of plot.
I picked up my phone a couple times, and I was convinced that I had missed like the plot. Like I checked like a text or something and I looked back up and they were doing something and I was like, I clearly missed something, and I rewound and it's like, nope.
No, it's just
I think I realized that and did I miss something or does Cody walk into the restaurant and say, I'll save her for $10,000.
$10,000.
He walks in.
And then it immediately flips back though, where he's like, I don't want to pay that. And he's like, do you want me to save her or not? And you're like, wait, you walked in with the offer.
Well, he has a line, though. What Ludwig's saying, he has a line. He comes in. He suggests the amount of money. He suggests the plan. Rick Moranis is just sitting there. And then a few lines later.
Yeah, by the way, Rick Moranis is in this movie.
Yeah, Rick Moranis is in this movie. Just humble
brag. As like the exact polar opposite of every other character that he ever plays.
Yeah, Rick Moranis plays an asshole.
Yeah.
And it's kind of great.
Should have played the sidekick soldier guy. That should have been like that, like a Moranis-y role where it's like he's just the shrimpy little yes.
You got to you have to have the unreplicatable Lee Ving in that role.
Is that her name?
His name is. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about
you
the
talking
bomber's
about?
Sidekick, played by an actor and a punk rock musician named Lee Ving.
Yes, not him. He's who has been in other movies. I'm talking about Uncle Buck's girlfriend.
The character's name.
I
is
thought
Baby
she
Buck.
Was good.
She's great. I think she is the best in this movie, and other than Defoe, but that doesn't really count. The person who's most in sync with what. You need to do to make this work, I think.
You're talking about Amy Madigan as McCoy.
Yeah, McCoy.
Oh,
yeah.
McCoy. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
McCoy.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm blanking on the name. I've
She's
only
great.
Seen this 3 times in 3 months.
But yeah, I think that conversation having gotten completely flipped around in the span of like 5 lines of dialogue, I think was my moment of being confused of what that this was just the plot.
I noticed time watching where he even has a line into that scene where he's like, you rich people think you can just buy us off and have us do your dirty work. And I'm like, dude, you walked in here.
I want 10 grand.
Easy. All you got to do is earn it.
I'll earn it. And you're going to help.
Look, Cody, you sound pretty dumb, but nobody's that dumb. I'm the one paying you. That means you go get her, I wait here, and you bring her back to me.
You smart guys. You always figure you can hire a bum like me to do your dirty work. Well, not this time.
Yeah, you proposed the plan.
You proposed the plan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we give 30 seconds, though, to Bill Paxton and his, like, silver tooth?
Yes. Another pretty good role in this. Like, he nails what he has to do, where he's kind of
just
like,
getting
it's
beat
a,
up.
It's a nothing role
nothing.
Where he plays a bartender that gets shit on by everybody.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and he has a great time doing it.
And that pompadour. That is
man.
It's high.
That thing looks like a Lego piece.
Between that and whatever the haircut is that Willem Dafoe's wearing.
I don't know what that is. I was too distracted by his overalls of a fisherman.
A fisherman reel into BDSM.
Yeah. I was too distracted by the lack of motivation for him to be doing any of this.
I don't know what. Yeah. Well, he's got that throwaway line where he's like, oh, you just like he's talking to Ellen Aim when she's tied up to the bed, which is just like you might as well be on train tracks. But he's like, why don't you and me hang out for a week or two? We'll fall in love and then I'll let you go. And I'm like, man, even the like little plot they have, they're like underwriting to be like,
yeah, well,
the stakes are.
That's the point of the movie is it's a fairy tale.
I know. I'm not. I don't want anything to change. I want you to know that, Connor. Movie has to exist.
I don't mind so much that it's a fairy tale. I mind that it's so poorly written. Not written in terms of plotting, but just like written in terms of how characters are talking to each other.
The dialogue and the acting in the dialogue is bad. I will.
Yeah, it's the Star Wars problem. It's the Star Wars problem.
Yeah.
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 And. You don't have Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, and Carrie Fisher to elevate it. You have Tom Cody, who's Michael Pare. How do you say his last name?
Pare.
I thought it was Parr.
Michael,
I don't know.
Well, whoever. The guy who plays Tom Cody is so unforgivably awful in this.
As long as he doesn't say anything, he's great.
Yeah, he looks. Yeah, looks
yeah.
perfect.
I was just going to say, like, at delivering lines.
Yeah,
and when he's beating people up, he's like a great like action body. You know, like that moment where he gets out of the car, and he's got like the coat flowing behind him, and he puts the two halves of the gun together, like in silhouette. Like that's an action star thing, and I was totally bought in, and I loved.
I thought you were going to name his only great. Moment, which is when he walks in front of an actual moving bus and puts his hand out and physically stomps the bus and it jolts him back. Like, I don't, that is a real actor almost getting hit. Well, actually getting hit by a car on camera, and he doesn't even flinch.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone have any suggestions for who they would rather have playing Tom Cody? Because I have a small, I have a short list.
I got a couple of ideas. Has anyone seen who they were trying to get for it?
No, I didn't see that.
The main one they were courting was Tom Cruise.
That's on my list.
Would have been great. Would have been great at the time. Patrick Swayze was another one, and then Eric Roberts.
But then he would have been the same height as Rick Moranis.
Swayze would have been Tom Cruise.
Yeah, you can cheat it. But I feel like every 80s movie, Tom Cruise is on like crazy risers for...
Cruise in 84 had too much like boyish charm and energy, I think, for this character. You really need somebody that's like been through the shit.
The other ones that I had off the top of my head were Kurt Russell, Sean Penn, or Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
Kurt Russell would have been making fun of the material maybe too much, but I would like to see that version a lot.
Yeah.
I would go a little crazier with it because I think the way this role works well is like the same way Jack Sparrow worked well, where you write a totally straight, serious action hero and then you play it like so crazy and weird, but the actual heart of it is like true to what you need it to be, that it works really well. So I would go with someone like Jeff Goldblum, who is just like, if Jeff Goldblum's doing his thing while he keeps like circling back to be the like cliched 1950s, put your dukes up like action hero, you might end up with something that's like really interesting.
The other one I had was if Jeff Bridges was 5 years younger, he's like, too old for this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the role is written as a cowboy. It's like he has the same basic plot arc or story arc as like Shane, but he doesn't die at the end. So you would need Clint Eastwood in 1974, like 10 years before, to have like a really great actor in that particular role. But the thing is, because of who the character is, I kind of like that the actor is great when he's not talking, you know, like, just like as a physical specimen. Honestly, if I was going to fix the flick, so to speak, I would just have him speak way less.
What if he didn't? What if you go full Grand Theft Auto 3 and just like
didn't talk at all?
Doesn't.
He just didn't talk and no one found it weird.
Well, like, or like have him only talk when he has to communicate, like, you go here, you go there. This is the
point. Well, it would be the Mad Max thing.
Yeah.
If you give him that treatment where you have this really realized world that he is just forced to react to, great.
Yeah.
I think you accidentally found the perfect actor for this.
That was no accident. I've planned this from the beginning, Frank.
But Tom, the year the movie came out aside, like Tom Hardy, like 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The remake of Streets of Fire. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought you were going to go Mel Gibson. I was like, let's sidestep that landmine.
Yeah.
Although Mel Gibson in 84?
Sure. Yeah.
Maybe.
He might be too old.
Or
was that 80? Was this before Road Warrior?
Road Warrior is 81 or 80? I don't know.
The original
Road Warrior was 81. So this should be closer to Lethal Weapon time.
Mm. Yeah, that would work. But I think
Lethal Weapon's 87. I mean, that's still in the ballpark.
It is weird that they consciously, one of the things they did for this movie was they were like, nobody's over 30 is like a thing they did on purpose. And it's interesting.
Except
all of the authority figures.
A little bit, but even they are not that old.
No,
like,
yeah, they're still fairly young.
Creating a fantasy. I mean, they're creating a fantasy world where they smash together Elvis movies, westerns, noirs,
and Flashdance,
and like
and Meatloaf,
John Hughes teen dramas or teen comedy.
Little of that in there.
You know, like. The whole thing at the end where she's like, you know, I'll never forgive you for only rescuing me for money is such a teenage stakes argument to have.
That money is such a bigger part of the plot than I needed it to be. That's all the only thing the movie has for like a 30-minute chunk towards the end is like him taking money to rescue her.
I probably would have been okay with mid with mid-1980s Meatloaf, by the way, in this movie.
That'd be good.
Yeah, what if Meatloaf played Cody?
What if Meatloaf played Cody?
No, Meatloaf would have to play Diane Lane and McCoy.
Or that. Meatloaf. Yeah. This movie could have been much more progressive. Meatloaf.
I do love the... First of all, this movie does something that I didn't realize I wanted, but I think every Batman movie should have, which is like... There's no establishing shot of this city.
Yeah.
And it seems like the city is endless. They're never not in like a very busy area, even when they could travel. And there's a throwaway line where they talk about going to the Battery.
Yeah.
And they say it takes a couple hours to drive there. So I think the idea is this is like a megapolis where there's
Because outside of the city is just the wasteland, Frank. Because
it's dirt city, Frank.
Yeah. I love that that to get in and out of quote unquote town, he takes a subway.
Yeah.
It's not not like a regional train. It's not an Amtrak.
There's no plane.
It's a subway.
Yeah. It's a subway. It's I like that where it seems like it is this sort of like dream where you can't, like you're saying, Dark City, where you just do not leave it no matter what. There's also, I think there's a couple throwaway lines about like a war that happened or is happening still. Or so. I know
he's
was
a veteran.
He's a veteran, of what? Like, it seems like it is a...
He and McCoy both talk about being soldiers, and he's like, yeah, but I like shooting the guns, but I didn't get a medal or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it great how they both talk about soldiers? There's no detail behind any of that. And the way that they tell you that they're cool and know how to use a gun is just by saying, well, they just constantly reference that they were a soldier. And there's no background as to what that means.
Yeah.
That might be half of McCoy's lines.
My name's McCoy. I'm a soldier. At least I was up until about a year ago. Ran out of wars.
Yeah? What's your spec?
Motor pool. Nothing fancy. But if it's got wheels, I can drive it and I can fix it.
That's funny. I just got out a couple months ago. Been R&R ever since.
Yeah, how'd you like the Army?
I like shooting the guns, but I didn't win no medal.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Fucking Tom Cody, dude. That is such a ridiculous guy. But I do like the image of him with the carbine repeater, which I did not even think about how cool that gun is until this movie, because it's a really cool gun.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially the one, again, that like breaks down in half so you can pack it away and then you snap it together.
And yeah, just him, just a cowboy on like modern city rooftops, and it's not weird or gimmicky, where it is just like you're in, it's like the old West, but instead of it being this wide expansive world, it is so crowded and industrial that you're just as like isolated, you know?
And there's motorcycles fucking everywhere. Can we talk about the motorcycles, guys?
What motorcycles?
Well, like in that first scene, when the bombers raid the concert and steal Diane Lane, and they're all trying to, they're all escaping, there's like 8 or more motorcycle crashes where guys just go over their handlebars and land on the ground.
Well, and dragging people or like, you know, honestly, really great stunt work in the first like 10 minutes of this film.
Yeah.
They're all like career stuntmen.
Yeah.
They eventually went on to become stunt coordinators and stuff like that.
All of the guys on bikes?
Pretty much. Yeah. When I was doing my research, it was like list them off and it's like stunt work, stunt coordinator, you know, visual effects, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, they're all professionals.
Yeah. And again, just like a Western, like the motorcycles are a stand-in for the horses when the gang rides into town and drags people behind the horses and does the same shit, you know?
Yeah.
It does help, though. Tom Cody looks cool as hell on a motorcycle.
Oh, my God.
That duster.
Well, first of all, it's not a jacket. It's a duster. It's like a jacket, only it's longer, thicker, and far more badass. I look like Lorenzo Lamas, and women find it irresistible.
Well, that part's just simply not true.
That scene where he pulls the motorcycle into the parking garage or under the overpass to meet up with them in the car. Just like, oh yeah, that's pretty what great. I've always wanted to look like. That's what I've modeled myself after.
He also, did anyone else laugh when he first gets into that diner fight and he takes the duster off and he has like
short sleeves,
a sleeveless button up with suspenders.
Yeah. And then proceeds to have a slap fight.
The slap fight. Yeah.
The butterfly knife slap fight is fucking fantastic.
It works. Yes. It works. I will say I immediately noticed, which should take a few watches, where it's like, okay, he throws someone through a window and those guys had done no damage to his sister's diner. Like he does a shitload of damage. What is that Streets of Fire siren I hear in the background?
I live not very far from a firehouse.
In the 70s?
In Jersey. I mean, in Jersey
it's
City,
up the hill, so
kind of.
Yes. Yeah.
First of all, rock break.
First of all, what's everybody drinking tonight? Because I had a request and I wanted to see who got it right. Mm.
I got it.
I was not able to fulfill your request.
Yeah. This is a ranch water. So this is a tequila, lime, and soda. Yeah.
Hey, you got any preferences?
I've always been a tequila man.
Speaking of which, I showed this to Amanda, who I think was just not in the headspace for it. I feel like she would have liked it if she was like even remotely prepared for what the fuck was about to happen to her face and ears. But one of the things she noted that kind of ruined it for me a little bit is Tom Cody is just like doing a Stallone impression with less of a slur. Like that's, I'm going to put a couple clips of like a Tom Cody line and a Stallone line and see if you can tell which is which.
Yeah.
I don't have to kill anybody. Motorcycles don't run so hard when you're shooting holes in them.
I'll blow this whole place up!
Go ahead. I don't shot her.
Hey, what's the matter with you? Are you looking to get yourself run over?
Me and my friends need a lift.
So what? This ain't no Muni bus.
You need a lift real bad.
You don't get
it's bad
it,
for
dude.
Your health, you know?
What is pinche?
Me.
I'm a hero of the new world!
You're a disease. I'm the cure. You know something? The only trouble with kicking the shit out of you is it would be too easy.
Now you knocked him down. Why don't you try knocking me down now?
He's trying to do like Northeast City accent. And comes off as Stallone because it's like Stallone has like that Italian American, almost Brooklyn, but by way of, you know, Philly thing going on. So it's like there's a lot of that happening, like where everybody's speaking like they're from some old-timey version of the Five Boroughs.
And, I mean, and the reason why Sylvester Stallone was a movie star and Michael Paré wasn't was that Stallone could take the same exact dialogue and make something out of it. I mean, like the writing quality of Cobra is not any better.
I really thought over the top was coming our way with that. I was not expecting Cobra.
But like the writing quality of any given Stallone action film from the 80s was not any better than Streets of Fire. It's just that Stallone had the charisma to make it sing, where Michael Paré I think he does a better job than the rest of the group seems to, but I mean, shit, Rick Moranis had trouble with this dialogue.
That's the problem is that everybody is, it's again, we're going back to, this is a Star Wars problem, is that like the dialogue is rough to begin with. And the performances that you're getting from everybody is like already, like they're going for two dimensional first level dialogue. Mm-hmm. So like it's not helping anybody who doesn't have the charisma to even carry that to begin with.
Yeah.
But you know. Yeah. Even if you end up presented with this, where I kept comparing it a little bit this time watching to Indiana Jones, which is 3 years earlier, Indiana Jones comes out, which is another movie that is hearkening back to older archetypes where the Indiana Jones character was in a million types of movies in the 30s and 20s, 30s, 40s and stuff, the Golden Age. And it was played totally straight, where it was like Humphrey Bogart or Heston or one of these guys who was just like strong jawed and like punch first. And most of Indiana Jones still plays that way. But there's enough moments where Indiana Jones like has a look on his face where he's like legitimately scared to make a jump, or is in over his head, or does something wrong and like freaks out, where it's like the dialogue doesn't necessarily need to have been changed, but like he has this human quality to it that there was plenty of room for Tom Cody to like have anything.
I think that's what Connor's getting at is like it's that charisma factor that you get from a Stallone or a Harrison Ford that you're just not getting here.
Yeah. Although sort of jumping on what you said, Frank, Michael Paré in the action scenes What I love about Tom Cody, as opposed to say Indiana Jones or John McClane, is like where those guys are completely overwhelmed by the situations they're in. Tom Cody is the most capable person in any fight scene he's in.
Yeah.
Like he's done all this shit before. Like that the scene where he puts Diane Lane in the car and he's like, "You guys go, I'll meet you under the underpass. I'm going to like work these guys for a few minutes."
What does he say? Yeah, that was a great line. I'm going to run these guys ragged or something.
For a few minutes. I'm going to buy you time by just being able to stand in the middle of this crowd and beat the shit out of people and start fires like that.
Hit motorcycles with the butt of a carbine repeater like it's a fastball.
Yeah.
Like
so there are I think he does very well in the moments where he's physically acting. It's just the dialogue itself that he wasn't
when he
able
rescues
to
her, he kicks the door in, looks at her, says nothing, doesn't even smile, does his butterfly knife thing and just like hacks at the bed and then picks her up and carries her out.
So I'm convinced that they cut some dialogue in an attempt.
I think you're right. I'm glad they did because that moment is fucking
badass.
Ridiculous.
It looked great.
It looked real bad. It's cool. That butterfly knife.
It feels like a bit of both. I don't know. I feel like some of the dialogue would need rewriting, and then some of it is just not carried by a lack of charisma.
I think you're right.
Like you could almost see a Stallone or a Harrison Ford pulling off some of those lines, but not necessarily all of them. And particularly not opposite like McCoy or because like no one else is helping the maybe other than Diane Lane almost no one else is really helping deliver those lines in a way that works.
Well, you're right. I think it's every line is cheeky and they can't all be that sort of like, yeah, you wise guy. You can't do that.
They're always fighting. They're always bickering.
It's
a lot of like, Cody and Fish are like fighting over like who's in charge, and you know Cody and
McCoy, McCoy and Fish, and Fish and Ellen.
Or McCoy. I mean, really, Fish. The Fish is the least well written character of the whole thing because he is an asshole at the beginning and stays an asshole all the way through.
He should have he should have gone a little more 3PO with it.
Yeah.
Just a little
more panicky. Although I gotta say the best line of the movie delivered by Deborah Van Valkenburg playing Reva, Tom Cody's sister.
Oh yeah.
Star Trek's Deborah Van Valkenburg.
What was she in Star Trek?
She played a hostage negotiator in the Deep Space Nine episode Past Tense.
There you go.
Okay.
And then one of the reasons why I knew so much about the stuntmen was that pretty much everybody who is on a motorcycle in this movie was a stunt person in Star Trek.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Played a clean hitting shot at one point.
I feel like we have to comment that she was in The Warriors because night and day, those two performances were.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
But when those greasers kick open her diner door, she says, "You guys really know how to come through a door." And I mean, delivered way better. I mean, Frank, cut it in now.
Oh, you guys really know how to come through a door. What are you trying to prove?
But it's one of the best, like, film noir deliveries of a line for the whole movie.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. It's like you would hear that in a Bogart.
There's also, like, I feel like there are lines that work pretty well, and some of the banter works well, and I think. But it's just that kind of thing where like they never really like have moments where it'd be so welcome to have a couple of lines in like a heartfelt scene that aren't like quite as cliche.
Yeah.
For the most part, it works well. But even like it would be really imagine this movie just as it is. But like anytime Tom Cody and Ellen have a moment together, they talk so normal and like matter of fact and relatable that you're like, fuck, this is like you can see that connection because you've spent so much of the movie building up an artificial sense of communication that once you finally get it, you're like, oh my God, these two are so in sync.
Yeah.
They almost get there when they're all on the train. Almost to that, it almost crosses that finish line, but doesn't quite get there.
And then he punches her and knocks her out, which is a moment completely broke
my
brain.
I mean,
I didn't know what to do with that.
Me neither.
Also, it's pretty much suggested that Willem Dafoe sexually assaults Diane Lane. Yes. So,
suggested, yeah. But we saw Tom Cody physically assault her.
This is true.
As the movie's conveying, all that Willem Dafoe did was tie her to a bed and leave her alone.
he tries to make a move.
Yeah. Those two things, tie her to the bed. Ellen gets punched, and you have the naked, sort of naked dancer, and this movie's rated PG.
Yes.
Which I find interesting.
Yeah, before the ratings change,
To be fair to all of you, it was another time, another place. This time watching that scene where they go to like the battery and they go to that bar, I forget the name of the bad guy bar. Torchies. That's great. Why in the love of God is, if you're going to be this over the top with it, why is like Ellen Aim not handcuffed to a stage and forcibly performing one of her numbers for like this gang? Because if that scene was there, I'd be like, oh, I totally get the vibe here. The bad guys want the valuable thing of the good part of town, and they've taken it and they're like replicating it in their shitty part of town. And suddenly everything makes sense versus like the sheer randomness of like Willem Dafoe. They don't know each other, but they're like.
It's because Raven wants her to herself. Wants her.
I know,
to
but
himself.
Can you imagine if they walked in there and Ellen Aim is like on a stage and it's all like it's her. It's the same song we heard in the beginning, but it's like an evil version with like naked background singers and like it's all dark and you know it's just like a full rave kind of thing. That could be fun.
Yeah. No. And it would also cement why Raven is in charge. Speaking of Raven.
Oh, we have to talk.
Willem Dafoe.
Raven Shattuck.
Shattuck.
He's so bad.
Willem Dafoe.
29 years old.
I mean, speaking of charisma, we've been talking about a lack of charisma in this film. Willem Dafoe is basically in, I don't know, four scenes of this movie. But he's always in the background, lurking, just over everybody's shoulder.
His face acting is superb in this game, in this movie.
Yes.
Impervious to this shitty dialogue. Like, he delivers every line properly and nails it well.
I'll be coming for her. And I'll be coming for you, too.
That's sort of your over-the-top point, though, right? If you deliver all these lines while looking psychotic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of works.
Yeah.
Dude, when he comes walking out of the fire and is like, well. That's great.
He has one visual moment that was might have been like my favorite like acting moment of the movie, where it's the showdown with the police towards the end, and he's waiting on Cody to show up, and he says a line, and then he blows an air horn, and like all his cronies come running. As he's blowing the air horn, the corner of his mouth twitches, just a little bit. And it's such a cool, like, tiny detail that I know is intentional.
Oh, yeah.
But you can also see
that the air horn's actually going off, by the way. It's distorting the air around it, which I was like, oh, they actually went for
also,
it.
Also, like,
impressed.
The production design of this fucking movie, like, even the air horn looks like it's post-apocalyptic.
Just going to say, the air horn looks cool.
Mm-hmm. No, but the lip twitch is cool. The thing that really illustrates this problem that we've been discussing for most of the show is the first time that Cody and Raven interact, and Cody says, "You forget I have the gun." And Willem Dafoe's response is, "Oh, I can get guns." Like that is that is the night and day juxtaposition of a regular actor who's just saying his lines and a master craftsman. Elevating their performance. Because, I can get guns is fucking terrifying.
Yeah. It's also, it goes back to that. They consciously really wanted the violence to, for the most part, be very, like, bloodless. Mm-hmm. Like, I know a lot of, like, there's explosions all over the part of that scene, but, like, for the most part.
Apparently nobody dies in the movie.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. I don't think anyone actually dies in the movie.
But Cody is supposed to kill Willem Dafoe at the end. And
no,
he just knocks him out. Yeah,
but he's supposed to. They cut it to maintain their.
Oh, really?
Their rating, supposedly.
A lot of motorcycles.
Perry said that in an interview.
Can we talk about the showdown at the end? because I'm confused on what they're fighting for at this point.
I'm confused what they're fighting with.
I do think it's great how much it escalates. It escalates to a point where it then completely de-escalates immediately. And it's
the why makes sense. It's just the gripe of like Cody blew up their whole gig and they want revenge, but like it's an honor thing. So like they're fighting for who's essentially, it's a turf war type of thing. Yeah. That part doesn't confuse me. The part that confuses me is that they're throwing sledgehammers at each other. It's very much indicative of the axe fight from Backdraft.
Blue Balls moment from our podcast.
But like if you've ever had like a wood splitter or something like that that has a wooden handle, but it has a very heavy metal head to it. If you overstrike, so like if you're hitting the handle, the wooden handle to other wood, it's you got maybe like five strikes before the actual handle breaks, just because it's not designed to take that force. But they're just going full at each other as if it's American Gladiator.
I'll go even further with that. Even if, let's say, you're using the sledgehammers that will never break, the feeling in your hands when you hit the handle of an axe is a feeling no one forgets. Like that is, and that's all they're doing in that scene. Yeah. Not to mention hitting each other with sledgehammers.
Yeah. Well, and not just sledgehammers, hammers that are, they look like they're specifically designed to drive nails
into railroads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, yes. I kept on trying to thematically make that make sense.
Under a subway.
Yeah. That's it. They're constantly under a subway track.
I don't know what that was. He brought two of them. Yeah. He has two.
Yeah.
That was another moment where I thought I missed a plot point where they agreed to a duel by hammer. No. And I was like, they seem to both be very down with this. So
They didn't really agree to a duel. He just showed up. And then suddenly everyone else says, so what does this mean? They fight and Tom Cody wins, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then all the good guys pull out guns. Deus Ex Machina style, as if that changes the fact that they were going to leave.
It's the turf war thing. Yeah. You're abiding by the rules of the situation. So like once the actual contest is over, that's it. And you have to abide by the rules.
It's like the first scene in Troy.
Let me ask you this, everybody here. What happens the next day after this fight? What happens the next day?
Well, they drove back 3 hours, right? So we just never interact again.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of what is implied is that Raven's position as leader is compromised because he's lost the fight and people don't have the same faith in him. And also,
there's a few close-ups of his second in command that I started to get that vibe a little.
Yeah,
bit. But they still take him with them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they go look their wounds. The problems will probably stay the same, but also like the town is now united to protect themselves against. Against the bombers. I mean, I'm a sucker for the town shows up moments.
Yeah,
yeah,
I am too.
Again, it's a very Western trope. And again, they're all armed with Winchester repeating rifles because Walter Hill really wanted to make a Western as well as a post-apocalyptic rockabilly noir cyberpunk movie.
He wanted to make everything.
Yeah. Every specific genre he tried to cram into this movie.
To be fair, all of those things to me actually blend kind of well.
Yeah.
The part that does not blend as well.
You know why? They're American. They're all genres that were invented here.
All of that works and looks good layered on top of each other. The part that the movie struggles with is what comes off as like an oil and water thing is like the 50s iconography and the 80s iconography is just, I don't feel like they blend. It feels like she's dressed like an 80s pop star, but the band is like a greaser style behind. It feels like I needed some better, and now we're going to go into our Treasure Planet dissection, but like, yeah, just some sort of better line of where one era ends and one begins, or where they sort of combine and they become their own thing. It just felt like nothing ever like.
Here's the thing.
So
it's all rock and roll.
Well, that is also rock and roll. But to me, it's also like, it's kind of like Happy Days.
Yeah.
It's the 80s version of how they remember the 50s.
Yeah.
Well, it's a retro clock thing.
Yeah.
Yes, that works. But then there are, once they rescue Ellen, they seem to go to another bar that is like full on 80s at some point, which that totally threw me, where it was like, what are they trying to say with, because it's like full on like leg warmers and neon.
Well, I mean, if you want a full like mind fuck, the that Countdown to Love song that's like pure R&B soul on the bus.
Oh yeah.
on the soundtrack for the movie is an 80s ballad. Mm. With the same soul, like, you know, 4-part harmony built into it, but it sounds like it was made in 1984. Like it's just purely sonically identifiable as that.
Even more of a mind fuck. Do you know the young girl they pick up, the last one to join the group, who's like a big fan of LMA?
Baby doll, yeah.
Do you know who that is?
No.
She is the voice of Tommy Pickles.
No shit.
That's E.G. Daily.
Huh. Well then.
Huh.
Can we talk about Ed Begley Jr. showing up randomly?
Do you mean Star Trek's Ed Begley Jr.?
Playing a character named Tom Gunn?
Bill Gunn.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Bill Gunn? Yeah. Bill Gunn?
Ben Gunn.
Ben Gunn?
Ben Gunn.
Isn't it Ben
God
Gunn?
God damn it. Ben Gunn?
The Treasure's Island was a long
time ago. It was a long time ago.
It's all...
I don't know what they were trying to do the Troll Under the Bridge thing.
But
a little bit.
Again, going back to the main theme of the show, guys that can elevate the shitty dialogue into something entertaining. When he looks at Rick Moranis and says,
"My gosh, you're scared. What's even funnier, you're afraid of me. Just trying to get away from you. We got some business here." "Oh, you're dumb. And you're short. Real short."
That really is one of the best lines in the movie. And
yeah.
I don't know, it's interesting. In an interview I was reading, Perry said that Rick Moranis drove him nuts the entire time they were filming.
Oh, really?
I can see that. He would be taking jabs at him, and he seemed to be under a lot of stress and just couldn't handle being made fun of by a comedian constantly, every day, for months.
It's and like it's how, just, you, it, how it, Tom Cody would handle it.
Yeah, yeah. So... a good punch to the face of Rick Moranis might have worked in this movie. Just like
didn't someone just do that?
Someone like just punched
did they
a couple years ago?
Yeah, it was about a year ago.
In real life, oh, yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
Although I mean,
not real life Rick Moranis. He's like an adult, you know.
The moment where Rick Moranis does get punched by Lee Ving at the very end of the movie is quite cathartic.
Yep.
You just want to keep saying that.
That's his man. That's the man's name. A man's name is Lee Ving.
You could just say Lee.
Mr. Ving.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the music of this movie.
Bangers.
My stance is the opening number and the closing number are fucking masterpieces.
Yes.
It's so good. Horribly filmed, because I realized this is kind of pre the MTV a little bit.
It's the very beginning of MTV.
No one knew how to film live shows properly, so they're trying their best, and you can see, but the musical numbers are awesome. Every other number in the movie, every other piece of music to me is so horribly distracting and out of place throughout this whole movie, even the like score throughout the middle of it. I don't know how anyone else feels about that.
I mean, I'll take offense to Jonathan Demme made Stop Making Sense in 1984, so somebody knew how to film live music. Yeah. But maybe putting that aside,
this is from 1983.
No, that's true. The soundtrack works with the movie, and like that's sort of the point. But it's sort of jarring every time music comes in, and I feel like that's sort of it feeds into this fact that, like, you don't really know when this world is supposed to be taking place.
A bit.
So sometimes you're in a 1950s car, and then a 1983 banger comes in.
Yep.
Yeah. It's jarring for me a bit.
I got Suicide Squad vibes. I really did.
Hmm.
It just felt like needle drops.
God, I love that though. I love the fact that you like, to me, I immediately was just like, okay, this is an alternate universe. This is just another world where these time periods are smashed together. I thought the moment where they sing the countdown to love on the bus was really, really, really lovely.
That song is fire. That song is actually fire.
That was great.
It's wonderfully delivered.
Can I offer you an olive branch, Connor?
Yeah, of course.
I got the vinyl, man. Mostly for the great. Artwork.
I would say that cover is incredible, which I was going to say, one of my favorite things about this movie is the poster. The poster is awesome.
Yeah, the poster is amazing. I almost bought it a couple times. It's really
Do we know who did the cover?
I don't know. I really don't.
Because I have not seen another poster in this art style, I don't think, ever.
No. I wish there were more. I wish there was more imagery with that style. It's really just that one image. But I think also that this to me nails it a lot better in terms of like the combination of all elements, where she's full 80s, he's full Western, and there is like a 50s to the city behind them and everything, and it blends nicely. So it might have been more of like even a color palette would have adjusted it more. I feel like this is ripe for a really interesting remake, I think, and I don't like saying that for a lot of movies.
Well, this was also the first one, you know, like if there wasn't, if not for this movie, there wouldn't be Sin City. There wouldn't be...
Well, and this was supposed to be the first of a trilogy.
Yeah, it was supposed to be,
Where do you go from here?
The Tom Cody series.
Have I got a treat for you guys?
Does
anyone not know this, what I'm about to say? In 2008, someone made a sequel to this movie with Michael Pare as Tom Cody.
You're fucking
kidding. No way.
And what I'm about to show you is, clear your heads for a second. I'm about to show you the worst trailer ever seen. This is Tommy Wiseau makes Sin City. This is what this is.
Oh,
no.
We're taking a second. I might have to cut this all out, but we're taking a second to watch the actual.
You're retroactively ruining this movie for Connor.
This is the official. It was like a fan made kind of movie, but it was like an actual movie. Oh, okay.
Feature length.
It's a feature length movie, but Michael Pare is in it. So the movie's called Road to Hell. I'm so sorry. Okay. Are you ready?
Monster.
Tell me how loud it is.
We never will be.
You monster. That's upsetting.
That was...
So, Connor, your homework assignment.
No, don't make me do it.
Should you choose to accept it?
I think I need you to. I bet you it's... definitely available on Vimeo. So that happened. They made one. But yes, this was supposed to be the start of a trilogy called The Adventures of Tom Cody, which I would have really liked to see an official second one to see what is Streets of Fire and what is like the world, like the series. Like, what are the elements that continue on? Is Ellen in any of the other ones, or is it like a whole new adventure where he's the same and maybe McCoy's in it? It goes to a whole new part of the city. It could be, there is a lot of room to play with this world.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Cause there's nothing you're messing with if you're playing with it. It's all open space. Little space is filled in.
Yeah. Imagine the second one is like the 40s combined with the 90s. Yeah, that happened. Sorry to put that taste in your mouth, but you needed to see it for your own eyes.
Yeah, 2008. What a time.
Yeah.
What a time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shooting on that Panasonic HDV200.
Oh, yeah.
Hey. That just depressed me so much.
Yeah.
That looks like they filmed it in 2 weeks, and it's a lot of like porn actors trying to make good.
It feels like it was filmed in the same green screen room, the whole movie.
Yes, the whole thing.
100%.
They could afford to get Michael Pare for a day, shot out all of his scenes on green screen, and just...
Is it the first geezer teaser? It might be.
It might be.
Well, but that would suggest that Michael Pare is like a star that they have to like.
Can anyone here?
I don't mean this
anyone,
like I don't mean this as a slight. I just like it's not a thing
you're right.
They would have to worry about how many days they would have to. You know they. You know
Michael Perry's career
they,
has been pretty sad. He's been in mostly Uwe Boll movies
and the TV adaptation of the Philadelphia Experiment.
What's the biggest thing he was in? If it, off the top of your heads, don't look if you have it up. But
this
the biggest
could not
ever,
tell
prob-
you
other
this.
Than this, other than
no.
this, like
no.
The only other thing I
no
found
idea.
Was he was in John Carpenter's Village of the Damned in the 90s. And he, once you, if you watch his scenes in that, you probably find it on YouTube and you see like what, how he plays that versus how he plays Tom Cody. You're like, oh yeah, he's not a very talented man. Like it is.
Oh! He was in Fix a Flick favorite, The Philadelphia Experiment.
That's what I just said.
Yeah, no. That's what Peter.
But
said.
it was the TV version of the movie, not the actual.
No. Sorry, I was busy looking at the Wikipedia page. Cut that out.
I
can fix that.
He's also in The Virgin Suicides and The Lincoln Lawyer. So you know, cool.
The Lincoln Lawyer. Oh my God. Yeah, weird career, but he looks good in this movie. He also has like, I can't tell if I hate his facial hair or if I think it's perfect.
The weird, like the weird
stringy
growth of a Civil War general look that he had.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that's intentional? Or do you think that's just how he grows a beard? Cause I've never,
I think
really
that's
seen
just how
that.
He grows a beard.
Because it's like a
I don't think you can fake that.
It's a more drastic version of like how Chris Pratt had it in like Guardians of the Galaxy. There's like a there's like you do the scruff, but it's like patchy in like a way that
Because
works.
Like Chris Pratt can't really grow a beard either, so it's the same problem.
Yeah, I think it works for what he's supposed to be in his 20s.
Yeah,
and for the aesthetic of this world, it kind of fits his. His character, but he does look great, which apparently was him wearing like $20,000 worth of designer clothing throughout the entire movie.
Really?
That's crazy. I mean, it is a nice, nice duster. I really like that.
It's great. Apparently it's Armani. So in case you...
Jesus Christ. What's even funnier and a bigger waste of money was the fact that the reason that's called Streets of Fire, which you probably all saw, was it was supposed to be the what's his name? Now I'm blanking.
Springsteen.
Yeah. Song. And they were so confident they were going to get the rights to the song because it was supposed to be the song that ended the movie instead of what they have, that they filmed the ending with that song, then didn't get the rights, and then had to, months later, rebuild the set, refilm a new ending with a song that the guy who wrote it took 2 days. He only had 2 days to write it. So that Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young is written by the same guy who wrote the opening number, wrote it in 2 days, and then they filmed it completely from scratch. Cost them $1 million to redo that entire ending. I listened to both songs today, and if they had the Springsteen song, it would have sucked so much compared to what they had in there. But I will say my only note from the first time I ever watched this before I like that song really got going, I wrote down that ending song should have been that one from Footloose, Holding Out for a Hero. I thought that would have been perfect for the end of this.
Yeah.
I think that would have nailed it.
It kind of fits this movie, though, right? That they named it after a song that and just assumed that it was going to work out. I don't know. I agree that I think the Springsteen song is fine, but it would have added something to the movie to have a Springsteen song featured.
It's a great song. It's a great song, but just not for that ending.
It's great to then read what they then announced publicly is that they changed their mind from using the Springsteen song because it would have been too much of a downer. And it's just, it's a nice little spin from they couldn't get the rights and clearly wasted a lot of money as a result.
Yeah. I mean, the whole, that set they built of the underbelly of the subway was built with a giant tarp over the top of it so that they could film daytime scenes at night. So like that whole giant street that the biggest set in the movie is fully covered. Like it's a football stadium basically they built for this, which is ridiculous on so many levels.
In the same interview with Perry, he talks about how birds would collect on top of the tarp. So before they started filming for the day, somebody would have to go out and shoot off one of the prop guns to scare away all the birds.
Oh, that's
awesome. I think is also just fitting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also, I do like that set a lot. Maybe it's just because you've all been to my place. I live right by almost an identical kind of train setup where it just runs right through. Like if you were to walk further out into Queens from where I am, it's kind of awesome. It's full on like Matt Reeves Gotham style setup.
And it does have a 1950s meets 1980s vibe. So yeah,
that's, I think that set is one of the most perfect things in the movie. It works well where it's like, it's a modern industrial sort of setup, but like a lot of the storefronts are very 50s. There's something in, and I have to go back and rewatch it because I haven't seen it since we watched this movie, but I keep wanting to go back and check out, Little Shop of Horrors in relation to this, because I think their set design could have been something interesting to look at, which Little Shop came out after this, I think. But it has that same thing, which has like really cool stylized outdoor city street design to it that feel really similar. It's not just because Rick Moranis is in both, but I feel like that kind of hits the tone right, where it's like very like old school, but it's not trying to be modern either. It's kind of, it's the Gotham thing where it's supposed to be timeless. And I think timeless is cool, but the, like, it's either very 50s or very 80s kind of goes against what you're trying to accomplish with it, I guess. That trailer ruined this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I keep on thinking about how this could have been different if they just had cast anybody else.
I know.
Like somebody who could actually,
I would have loved that.
Like but between that and then like done a couple rewrites of dialogue like on set.
Yeah.
Like those two little tweaks I think changed this movie's score drastically.
Yeah. If
those are more than little tweaks though.
Yeah, I mean if you rewrite all of Rick Moranis's dialogue so he's not always trying to pick
saying
a fight,
it's the shits.
I thought, did anyone else think him and McCoy were gonna like start to like each other by the end? Like I was like, I feel like that's,
I would have enjoyed it if anyone started to like each other.
Yeah, that's the thing. By like the end, arc of the movie really should be these people that are mercenary in one way or another, or literally a mercenary, go off on this adventure to save the princess, so to speak, hating each other and come out comrades. That would have been one thing. You know?
Well, that was my biggest sort of like the single note, just sort of structurally from a story perspective. It's weird that they wrote it where they get back to the Richmond and then kind of hang out for a day, yeah, and then Willem Dafoe shows up versus like the movies them getting back. And when they finally do make it back, Willem Dafoe is there waiting for them. That little tweak was always weird to me. The fact that they, you know what I mean?
Well, that lull should be where the characters come to an understanding of, oh, okay, we actually kind of get along, or like we're in this together, and start changing where they just don't. And so like that's why it feels almost like wasted time that kind of throws off the pacing of the movie because nothing's actually changing or happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can do that lull if like they are hiding out in an abandoned building and it's raining, so they have to like, you do the rain piece that you want that in there because that was great.
Yeah.
But like they're not home yet, you know?
Yeah.
When you mentioned, somebody mentioned Tom Cruise and Cope before, like what happened to those potential actors? Like, did they actually go after them, Or
they went after Tom Cruise, but he had signed up for something else. And I don't know what it was at this point. 84 Cocktail, maybe? I don't know.
It sounds like through some of the like Wikipedia and some of the interviews that they just offered the part to Michael Paré.
Yeah, I think they liked him. They legitimately wanted him for this movie.
I did read a thing that the only reason that they even knew that he existed was he had the same agent as Eddie Murphy.
That's funny.
So the agent suggested him.
Yeah. Well, and they had kind of taken a swing on Eddie Murphy for 48 hours, and it had worked out really, really well. So I think like you were saying, Frank, they kind of also just decided to take a swing on Michael Paré, and assuming it would work out.
Seems
the
like
same
they. They didn't seem to do much background on whether or not that was a good idea. One of the things that they were, apparently he didn't know how to ride a motorcycle before this movie either, and they were teaching him how to ride a motorcycle on set.
Well, he figured out how to look like he knew how to ride one because
he figured it out.
Looks amazing on a motorcycle.
Just feels like a lot of acting motorcycle skills.
Yeah, it's a lot of that. You cast a stuntman. You might as well cast a stuntman because they're going to act just as well at that point. Yeah. It's funny, dude. The amount, how, and I feel bad because everyone involved are filmmakers and creatives that I really like. And they were so happy when they were coming up with this and making this movie. And like this legitimately crushed a ton of people involved because they thought they were like, going to hit the biggest home run ever. And they were trying to. It wasn't this sort of cash grab. It wasn't anything like that. They were just like, we want to make the movie we're most excited about. We're not thinking about anything else, but like the kind of movie we want to watch, the kind of movie we're excited to make. And they were just so blind to so many of the different pieces that they needed to be focusing on. It's kind of crazy that they made this many small but pivotal miscalculations in a row.
Yeah, but at the same time, they got to make exactly the movie they wanted to make, and I like to celebrate that. And
I'm not regretting that this exists.
You know, and two of my favorite video games growing up came out of this. However many movies were inspired by it, Willem Dafoe's entire career. I wonder how much. When was Phantom of the Paradise made? Because I feel like this and Phantom of the Paradise have a lot to do with each other.
Well, can I also add something that we're kind of taking for granted? This is pre-Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
The idea of a kind of realistic world that's this stylized was a little unprecedented.
Yeah.
Where even movies like, and I think Wikipedia calls this one out too, where it's like even movies like Seven, which are just subtly fantastical in the world that they're set in, do owe a little bit to like what this did, where it's like, no, you can change the dials and you don't have to always go for ultimate realism in how things are presented. And you can create a very alien world that's full of familiar iconography without completely inventing new things by just like making sure what you're pointing the camera at and what's out of frame. This city is so labyrinthian, even though it's like two sets and some on location stuff in Chicago. And it is really, it does work as this, like, it's as fantastical as they wanted it to be. And in that regard, they kind of succeeded.
Yeah. I love it. Everybody should go watch it.
Everybody should go watch it.
My two favorite things about this movie, Frank, hold it up one more time. The poster / that vinyl cover is incredible. Yeah. It's so cool. And the other thing that is just so cool is the name Ellen Aim and Ellen Aim and the Attackers.
Yeah.
Is incredible.
Great band name.
It's incredible. That's my favorite part of the movie.
It rolls off the tongue like something Tolkien would have like obsessed over. Like he would have just been like, yeah, it's cellar door. It just flows. Perfect.
It feels like they started with Tom Cody and Ellen Aim and the Attackers. And they were like, what's the movie?
What's the world that these two characters live in?
What's the movie we can say these words the most in? Raven Shattuck, dude. The names are solid in all this. The Richmond, awesome name for the club? Is it the club or the neighborhood?
It's the neighborhood.
The neighborhood. It's
kind of neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Okay. I get confused with the, I think it's the Garrison from Peaky Blinders is another, is like the bar. But yeah, Richmond's great. The Battery is just, that's just classic any city. I feel like most cities have a Battery at some point. Yeah, I do like this movie a lot. And I, and mathematically I shouldn't, but you can't help but I kind of,
I'm genuinely surprised to hear that after the last hour and a half of conversation.
No, no, no. I again, like I watched this twice in 2 days. I watched it a third time yesterday. Like, it's crazy that this exists, and I'd much rather have this than like even the better half of like MCU movies. Like, because this is just like insanity that anyone would have made this at any time, at any place.
There's also, I texted you this, Frank, but there was a part of 2022 me that really appreciated a tight 90 minutes.
Tight 90. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, shout out then to Amanda's Substack. She's been writing blogs every week on different 90 minute movies is like the theme of it, because like it is a lost art a little bit. And goddamn, you can, if you do a 90 minute movie correctly, like you can make you, it can feel like a 10 hour sort of like world you've entered in a good way.
It doesn't feel like it's 90 minutes, but in a good way.
In a good way. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a tight 90, and it does not feel like 90. Like, it doesn't really drag, because there's not much for it to even drag, honestly.
Well, I mean, the opening song is 5 minutes, and the closing song is 5 minutes, so it's kind of a tight 80 in between.